This is the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast with Andy Benoit and your host, John Engel.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the MMQB Podcast with Andy Benoit. I'm John Engel at Engel's Angle on Twitter, along with Andy Benoit at Andy underscore Benoit. In order to bring you the best football coverage possible, Andy is live in Mobile, Alabama for the Senior Bowl. Andy, what's up?
How's it going? Now, can you really be live for a podcast, especially one that I know where you're going to be posting in a few hours from now?
Well, you're live for me, and that's all that matters.
Oh, good. Then that's what I'm here for.
Exactly. That and all the great college football you're going to love to see.
Yeah, I know. We've discussed that. I saw Matt Bowen in the lobby here at the Holiday Inn downtown. And we spent 5 minutes just bashing college football. Just
wow.
Talking about, but Matt, he does it with big-time specifics. Like he says, he mentions specific plays from specific games and how dumb they were, which means he still watches college football, though.
Yeah.
I didn't know what he was talking about the whole time.
You need to find a little more support for your argument so you can be like him.
Yeah, well, and he's going to always have support for his arguments because he played, too, so he
That's
knows
true.
What he's talking about.
That always helps. With 2 weeks left until Super Bowl 49, we're going to spend this show breaking down what happened in the championship round and, when necessary, extrapolating on some of what might happen in the Super Bowl. But the big breakdown of Seahawks-Patriots will come next week. We'll do championships for the first 30 minutes or so here and then go around the league for the second half of the show. Andy, first things first, you're in Mobile, but the Seahawks, they're in Seattle and they're pretty happy right now, that big win over the Packers.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite the game. You know where I watched the game, by the way, before we get into analysis?
Oh, great. Hopefully not with Seahawks fans.
No, I watched it by myself, but you know how I like to watch these on DVR?
Right.
And I remember last year the low point of my trip to Mobile by far was watching the championship games in my hotel room because I was not used to all the commercial breaks and stoppage.
You forgot
so
that there were...
I put an ad on Craigslist looking for someone who would share their home with me for the afternoon for $250.
You have got to be kidding.
No, and I found a guy, I won't say his name or address, but he was in Robertsdale, Alabama. And then when I Google Earthed the house, I noticed it was on all dirt roads, not a paved road in sight on the Google Earth. But I rolled the dice and went there anyway, and he was phenomenal. He stayed out of my hair, and even with he was watching the game in the other room. And even with the Packers-Seahawks outcome, and that's a game that even a common fan would probably react to very verbally, he gave nothing away at all. Turned out to be a great day, and I was safe. Tell my family, all of them who keep asking, I was safe.
That's good. I'm glad we didn't have to send out the search party for you while you were in your mysterious home with your new best friend. Wait, I have a quick question for you. What page on Craigslist did you post a request to use someone's DVR on?
Yeah, other people have asked me that. I posted it on Gigs.
Gigs?
You know, like a paid gig.
Nice. That guy did well.
Yeah. No, he worked out. He's a school teacher. He's a nice guy. I was very impressed.
Was this the best championship game you've ever seen, Seattle and Green Bay?
No, because it was maybe the most exciting, and it was probably the best finish I've ever seen in a playoff game, at least a championship game. But I don't think it was a very well-played game, a lot of it. I mean, Russell Wilson did not play well. Green Bay, I thought, for a team that was leading, they played terribly. I mean, they did a lot of things wrong in this game, which we'll get into. It wasn't a well-played game. And I was surprised that when the Fox showed the graphic, there's been like 5 overtime games in the NFC Championship in the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years, in my lifetime, certainly. And a lot of those, I mean, a lot of them have been excellent like this. I mean, that remember the Vikings and the Saints a few years ago? That was a
yeah.
better championship game to me than this one. But, you know, we're splitting hairs here, and no one's complaining. I mean, this was as fun to watch as you could ask for.
Yeah, it was maybe a little sloppy at times, but, you know, still certainly entertaining, especially in the playoffs. Do you think, would you say the Seahawks won this one, or did the Packers blow it, like a lot of people are saying?
Normally, I'm a guy that likes to say, you know, it's a combination of both, and then I get into a big, long breakdown of why everything's a combination of both. I think I'm going to say the Packers blew it in this one, though. Certainly Seattle did some stuff to come back, and they made those plays at the end of the game, and they made an adjustment to man coverage and defense in the second half, and that really changed the tenor of the game. But Green Bay blew this, and they played not to lose. And there were five glaring examples of this, and some of this gets into coaching. And you know I don't like the – John, you know I don't like to criticize coaches.
Right.
But Mike McCarthy obviously kicking the field goal on both of those goal line situations early in the game. So there's two of them right there. The Morgan Burnett slide after the interception.
Oh, that was awful.
Oh, he had a chance to score on that play. And Julius Peppers tells him to slide, and he reacts in the heat of the moment and slides. That's a great example of playing not to lose. The decision to run the ball as much as they did late in the game, where they handed off and to force Seattle to burn timeouts, and they just, you know, they basically took the three and out. I think that was playing not to lose. And then to me, the worst example of the bunch was Dom Capers' decision to play what amounted to a prevent defense after the Clay Matthews sack, where they got the Seahawks into 2nd and 31, and then after that it was 3rd down and 19, and Seattle converted that with the big play to Doug Baldwin. That was a very poor defensive call. They'd been stifling Seattle man coverage all game, and then they transitioned to zone defense, just hoping to force, a check down kind of thing. And they made Clay Matthews a big part of the zone coverage. He dropped out, and it was a three-man rush. Clay Matthews is not a zone defender, especially at that kind of depth. He had to drop back deeper than usual because of the zone concept and the long down and distance. And he got lost in the coverage, and that's what happened on the play. I thought at the time that was really bad, and then in hindsight, that looks even worse.
Can you explain to me how that Clay Matthews sack and J.R. Sweezy slamming into him there at the end is not a dead ball foul?
Yeah, no, I can't. I think the refs probably missed one on that one. Honestly, I don't mind that not being a dead ball foul, because as an analyst, I like to see the yards match up to what happened in the game and not these extracurricular things after the play. But if I'm a fan of the Packers, I do have a problem with that.
So with this collapse for Green Bay, you say that it's more of Green Bay losing it, but Seattle coming up big once again. What did Green Bay do that stifled Seattle offensively in the beginning of the game?
They were outstanding in their man-to-man concepts. Man coverage on the outside, and then they played zone concepts on the inside, and they did a lot of man-free lurk concepts. That was what they were going to do on 3rd and long. That was clearly their game plan. And there's two elements to what we're talking about here, and they both tie into the same thing, which people are not going to be surprised about. When you play man-to-man outside but zone inside, which Dom Capers and the Packers have done before, that's a great way to stop Russell Wilson in the passing game. You control his scrambling that way because those inside zone defenders essentially can act as spies on him. They've got eyes on the quarterback. They can move with him, and they did that very well. And when you play man-free lurk, it's a similar concept because that lurk defender, man-free lurk, that's man-to-man with a single high safety over the top, and then the extra safety is just a roving lurker in the middle of the field, basically reading the QB and reacting to him. When you do that coverage, for one, you can jump passing lanes, which we saw happen a few times, but for two, there's another example of eyes being on the quarterback, and you can help control his scrambles that way. So Green Bay had a lot of success with those coverage concepts. Now, late in the game, Russell Wilson made some plays against them, and something he does late in the game is run the ball more, whether it's as a scrambler or as a read option. He is more apt to run the ball. In fact, I had my researchers break this down today. They spent a great deal of time tracking the stats and actually found an error with the NFL's official stats. Russell Wilson, 23% of his rushing yards this season have come late in the game in the fourth quarter or overtime of a one-score game. He's just more likely to run, and he's more effective there, and he did that against Green Bay late in this one. The big play to curse to win it, that was a cover zero blitz that the Packers did. First time they'd done it all game, and Wilson recognized that.
Why run that? Why not have safety help over the top in a situation like that when you know that a touchdown wins it? It's a one move away from a big game ender.
I think they were – recall that it was first down, and so I think they were really thinking that it was going to be a run play. And Green Bay, as Daryl Bevel said, he told Peter King this in the Monday morning quarterback column, Green Bay did a similar thing to the Seahawks in week one in that part of the field in a similar situation, like I believe probably first down, same personnel grouping, whatever it was. Green Bay had shown that before. Now, we could argue, why would you show it twice? But we're talking about two plays here out of what now at this stage of the game, plus the week one plays, that amounts to hundreds of plays. but they have a tendency to do that in that part of the field, and I'm sure Dom Capers has his reasons. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know what the reasons are, but it wasn't just a random call or a, hey, let's go for all or nothing here. Obviously, they wouldn't do that. They clearly felt there was an advantage to going cover zero, and they got surprised by the play call, and then the execution beat them. And really, they always say there's no defense for a perfect throw. As bad as Russell Wilson played, that was a perfect throw when he needed it
most. Oh, it was beautiful.
Because, yeah, Tremont Williams had very good coverage on the play.
Are the negatives that we saw from Seattle's offense in this game something to be concerned about leading up into the Super Bowl?
Yes, I think they are, because Russell Wilson did leave some throws on the field. There was no clarity or decisiveness when he was dropping back. We saw the Seahawks receivers have trouble getting open against man coverage, which is those people who've been listening to our podcast all year, they know that's nothing new. We've talked about that before. These guys don't separate well from man-to-man, and this offense, the way it's designed, they don't do a lot to help those guys get open against man coverage. The closest they do, they'll do some switch releases on wheel route type stuff for the slot receiver where he crosses with the outside receiver and gets up to the sideline. We saw them have a little bit of success, in fact, late in the fourth quarter with those wheel route concepts. But other than that, we don't see a lot of trips, bunches, and stack releases from Seattle. It's mainly a spread them out and throw kind of approach. And against good man-to-man teams, that's going to be a problem if your guys can't get open. And Green Bay is a good man-to-man defense. We saw that. They were the better team in this game. We saw that for 55 minutes. The Patriots are a much better man-to-man defense than Green Bay is. I think it's going to be a real problem for them.
You touched on this a little bit at the beginning of the podcast, but where do you stand on Mike McCarthy's play calling down the stretch there in the game? And if you're a Packers fan, you're probably pretty frustrated with him right now.
You are, and I get the sense Aaron Rodgers is frustrated as well.
Yeah, he's not relaxing anymore, Andy.
No, that's right. Yeah, get whatever he needs to know, a five-letter word for being upset. I don't know.
There's probably a few of them out there. We'll get the research team on that.
I think Green Bay as a whole, and McCarthy is ultimately responsible for this. I think they did play not to lose, and I'm very cautious when I criticize coaches because there's so many facts. Like that Dom Capers cover zero, I'm not criticizing that because I know there were a lot of factors that went into that decision. But overall, on the decisions they made, there was a pattern of behavior there of overly cautious approach. And so I'm very, very disappointed if I'm a Packers fan because I think we left an opportunity out there.
During the post game, Mike McCarthy mentioned that in regards to the play calling, they were shooting for 20 second half rushes and trying to still pound the ball. Is this an archaic way of play calling? Is this like the old school, like we have to hit these benchmarks? What do you think of that?
Yeah, it might be, and he came up short on the benchmark. They only had 14 runs
right.
In the second half, but they didn't have the possession. If they could have ran the ball effectively when they needed to, and perhaps that was McCarthy's mindset, is that we believe in our running game, and we're here with the lead. And what you do with the lead is you pound away, and put them, put the opponent out. But it didn't work out for them in that regard. Yeah, I think that's archaic to just go for 20, but they didn't get that close to it. So they were. My guess is they probably got away from it a little bit at times. I thought Aaron Rodgers moved really well in the game. Did you think he looked? I mean, he looked. We all agree he looked much better.
Oh,
than he
looked way
physically.
Better this week than he did the last couple.
Yeah, and so I would have done something to capitalize on that. I'm not saying you bootleg Rodgers or roll him out or anything because he didn't run well on that one 12-yard scramble that he had in the 2-minute drill at the end of the game.
That looked painful. That was hard to watch. He was like skipping to the sideline.
Yeah, I mean, he's doing what he had to do. I mean, I don't think anyone thought he was coming out of the game at that point.
Oh, no. He wasn't leaving the game unless he was in a wheelchair.
But what was clear is that he wasn't quite as mobile, but I think they still could have dropped him back and had him move a little bit or just dropped him back and let him throw. You might run the game and it's all second-guessing. I get that. We're second-guessing right now. But you might run the ball and try to run the game out. But you're built around Aaron Rodgers. That's why you have Aaron Rodgers. We're not talking about a top 10 QB. We're not talking about a top 5 QB.
Talking about number 1.
We're talking about number 1. Maybe number 2. I mean, it's a debate.
Oh,
but, stop. We're talking about an otherworldly talent there, and I'm a little surprised they wouldn't lean on him more. Something else that Green Bay has is an excellent screen game, and they did not go to that either down the stretch.
What's the tougher matchup for Seattle's D? Is it that Packers team they just saw, or is it the Patriot offense they're going to be going up against in the Super Bowl?
Oh, boy, that's a great question because they're two totally different types of offenses. Green Bay's built around talent.
A lot of playmakers. A lot of playmakers on Green Bay.
Exactly. And New England's built around scheme because there's not a lot of playmakers. Rob Gronkowski, and that's about it. I think the better matchup, I think the scheme one's easier to go up against. I think they'll have an easier time. Once the ball is snapped against the Patriots, they'll have an easier time. Now, the question is, can they handle all of the stuff New England throws at them before the snap? Green Bay does not throw much, if anything, at you before the snap. Aaron Rodgers will change the play, but they're not using pre-snap motion very often. They're doing a lot of isolation routes themselves and spreading out, and what you see is what you get, and you line up and play against them. New England tries to get in your head. They try to create mismatches and out-leverage you with their pre-snap tactics. And how Seattle responds to that, I think, will dictate the way this game goes. If I'm Seattle there, my thinking is I have the better defense by far than they, you know, my defense is better than their offense. We have favorable matchups across the board. I'm even comfortable with my linebackers on Julian Edelman in certain scenarios, which we'll get into probably more next week, really. But anyway, I think I just line up and play. I don't react to this pre-snap shifts and movements and stuff. I stay in my basic zones or maybe man-to-man, which they've done a lot more of and with great success lately. Whatever it is, I continue to play and don't make this a chess match against Brady. And my bet is I out-physical the Patriots.
How surprised were you that the Patriots thumped the Colts in that AFC championship?
Not that surprised. I mean, once the game got going and you could see how it was
you
going,
felt
didn't it,
it
feel, it felt like, other than that one touchdown drive Indy had, which was very, very impressive, but it was also aided by some mistakes on defense, you know, it was never competitive. And what happened was the Colts receivers could not get open against man coverage. Joe, we've been talking all year about man coverage and the value of it, and we saw it more.
That's
so
the theme of
this
season.
Game.
On offense, it's separating from man coverage. On defense, it's playing man coverage in these double-A-gap blitzes. Those are the buzzwords for this podcast.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, 15 minutes of that, and you've heard every podcast we've ever done.
Oh, stop. We're creative.
The Colts were not, by the way. They also didn't do a whole lot to help their receivers against man-to-man coverage with stack releases and switches and all that kind of stuff. They basically said, Andrew Luck, drop back and play, and let's hope the guys get open. And I thought Andrew Luck was fine. I mean, his numbers were deplorable, especially early on. But when your guys are not open, you have, you know, well, what are you going to do? If your guys are not open, tell me what you do with the football at that point.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And I was going back and watching that game today, and I was noticing these overthrows of Hilton and the underthrows of Hilton. But then that had to be a timing thing, right? The Luck wasn't able to get through his normal procedure when that line was performing a lot above their pay grade last week.
Yeah, I would agree with you because what you need to consider and why I like man coverage so much is not only can you, at its best, you stifle a receiver and prevent a throw from getting to him or you knock a ball down, but even if performed just to a decent standard, the physical contact of man-to-man or your ability to get in the receiver's way on his routes, that kind of thing throws off the timing of a pass play. And pass plays are built all around timing, and so you break that kind of, you break those pass plays down, and all it takes is one, maybe two, but often just one corner disrupting the timing of another receiver's route, and the defense gains a significant advantage. And that's why Darrell Revis is worth as much money as he is, because he can do that better than anybody. And what we saw from him yesterday was man coverage at its finest, because I think everyone who watched that game at some point totally forgot that Dante Moncrief is a person, is a player. They forgot he existed.
He's lost in the waves of Revis Island, man.
Oh, I mean, he was nowhere to be found, and I was wrong about how they'd use Revis. I thought they would put Revis on Hilton and try to make that the way, you know, try to make Hilton the Dante Moncrief. But they obviously were very comfortable putting Arrington in a safety on Hilton, and they did that extremely well in Week 11, and it worked. And I overthought it and thought, well, maybe we're going to change it up now. And obviously Bill Belichick, who knows a lot more about football than I do, he did not overthink it. And he said it worked great last time with man-to-man and safety help. There's nothing tricky about it. So it's not like the Colts will figure us out and suddenly defeat us or you know, use it against us. So let's just do it again this time.
Yeah, they know what they're going up against, but just can't beat it. That's what it came down to.
Yes, exactly.
And Hilton only finished, I think, one reception, 36 yards, so real quiet day for him. Who do you think Revis takes in the Super Bowl?
I think he takes Doug Baldwin. I think we don't overthink that one either. I mean, maybe you put him on curse, but the way I don't think so, because the way Baldwin plays, you know, the reason they put Hilton, a safety on Hilton, is because he's a very vertical player. He's their vertical threat. And so having a safety back there is essentially like having a cornerback who can afford to play with a 15 to 20 yard cushion. So two-man, that double team man-to-man concept against Hilton, that works really well. Well, Doug Baldwin, he's not a vertical threat. He might get vertical at times, but that's out of the play design. That's not by, you know, his own raw speed. And Jermaine Kearse is more of a vertical threat than him. So I would put the safety help to Jermaine Kearse's side, and I don't think Kearse can beat – I don't think he can beat Brandon Browner, but a Brandon Browner plus a safety is advantage Patriots. And then I put Revis on Baldwin because Revis is so good at the intermediate levels and underneath. And something that the Seahawks will do is try to work Baldwin open out of the slot with crossing routes or that wheel route concept we talked about. That's the extent of their man-beater game, but Baldwin's almost always the focal point of their man-beater concepts. Revis is exceptionally good at working through those kinds of things, and we saw that on his interception, in fact. The interception against Andrew Luck, where he worked through the pick route. Luck assumed the pick route was going to work and lobbed the ball out in the flat. It was an easy interception because Revis played it so well. He's the best corner in the league, obviously, but I think he's the best in the league at also just fighting through man-beater concepts and working out of traffic.
Andy, the way you're talking, it sounds like you don't believe in Doug Baldwin. Are you one of the haters that don't believe?
I get the sense you're alluding to something here.
You didn't hear this?
I thought he had a rant. Was this his rant?
Yeah, right after the game. It was very Sherman-esque that no one believed in the Seattle Seahawks when they were 6-4. No one believed. This was the best part. No one believed in us when we were down 16-0. How does he know? Watch ESPN app or whatever?
What is it with these Stanford? Wouldn't you think the Stanford guys would be a little more subdued?
I don't get it.
I don't either. And this will be the storyline now for we're going to have this Super Bowl week where people like me have to go there and justify their presence at Media Day and everything. And so we get these ridiculous stories and this over-examination of guys like Doug Baldwin and certainly Richard Sherman. So we're going to hear this not believe in us, nobody gives us. Some team in this game will decide that they're the underdog, even though Las Vegas is basically saying this is an even matchup. And I've never really seen a true underdog in a Super Bowl because – you know, might not be as good as the other team, but you made the Super Bowl. You're all professional athletes. So the underdog card, I don't have a lot of patience for, but some team and some player is going to really jump on it this week, and I can't wait to see who it is.
I think that's why Seattle's so polarizing. They're a great football team, but they don't let you find out that they're good. They tell you before you figure it out, you know what I mean?
Yeah, or they let you see it, and then they very loudly confirm what you just saw for you.
Did you see that? Did you see what I just did?
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, whatever. At the end of the day, it's all about football, and the only reason we pay any attention to these guys doing this is because they're winning football games.
Exactly. You touched on Revis and that secondary and how the Patriots' defense has really come together in the latter half of the season. Touch on the pass rush a little bit. It seemed like only pressure from three, four guys at times, and they were still able to disrupt Luck.
Yeah, they did. They were a little noisier last game than they have been throughout the season, and I wouldn't read too much into that. I look at the whole body of work, and the whole body of work says this is still not a very good four-man pass rush. But I thought they did a good job with stunts and twist concepts, especially on the left side of the defensive line, which would have attacked the right side of the Colts' offensive line, and they went after Joe Wright's really well. And the Seahawks, you know, they're not a great pass-blocking front five. and where they're really at their weakest is at right tackle, whether it's Justin Britt in there and he missed the championship game with a knee injury, or whether it's Alvin Bailey in there and he was very vulnerable to pass rush moves on an island last week. Whoever's out there, they have trouble at that position in pass protection, and I would expect that New England would once again attack that spot with stunts and twists. I don't know if you blitz, because, I mean, I was an advocate for blitzing Russell Wilson, and the Packers didn't do it a whole lot, but they were correct. They didn't necessarily need to. I think the Patriots can take a similar blueprint and not have to blitz so much. The one concern you do have, though, is when you rush four, and especially when you do these twists and stunts, you do leave yourself open a little bit to the quarterback scramble, because if there's four rushers, there's five gaps in an offense. So theoretically, the quarterback does have a running lane somewhere along the front line. But that's what a spy is for at the second level, and that's what zone defense on the inside is for. And as we'll talk about more next week, I expect New England to employ those tactics.
What do you think of Jamie Collins being used mostly in coverage? Not a lot of the double-A gap blitz like you predicted last week on the podcast that they would go with.
Yeah, I did. When I was thinking Aaron Rodgers was a little more stationary than he would have been there. You know, they still blitzed their linebackers quite a bit in that game. It wasn't from double A-gap concepts, but they did blitz the linebackers and have success with it at times. And that's something they do on running downs especially. So they treat it almost as a run blitz. As a concept, I don't mind having Jamie Collins in coverage. I do think he can be attacked when you split a guy out wide against him and basically make Collins be an outside cornerback against the wide receiver. Now, it's not a wide receiver. He's always going to be on a running back in those scenarios. But from the technique standpoint, I do think Collins can be attacked deep there. But the rest of it, everything else inside where he's moving between the numbers and away from the sidelines and reacting, I think he's as good as we've seen, or he's close to it. So however they use him, they're going to have success, because there's nothing really besides that press coverage on the boundary. There's nothing he can't do.
Give me your overall impression of your boy Andrew Luck. 12 of 33, 126 passing yards, two picks. What'd you think?
Well, I mean, I'm not a numbers guy, but at some point you have to acknowledge the numbers.
Well, eventually they hit you in the face.
Yeah, and that's kind of what they did. Again, he didn't have any help around him. I thought he still made a handful of really impressive throws to give his guys a chance, but nobody on the Colts played well yesterday or on Sunday.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Andrew Luck, we heard those rumors about his contract situation and the chance that they'd be giving him a big extension had they won that game. We'll get to that in just a minute. But let's hit on Tom Brady in the offense. Brady completed 65% of his passes for 226, three touchdowns, even in those windy, rainy conditions.
He was outstanding. I mean, his arm strength is the most underrated
physical
attribute of anybody in the league. Nobody talks about his arm strength. His ball can cut through the wind every time.
I thought that game was just Brady-esque. It was the epitome of Tom Brady.
Yeah, because he controlled it at the line of scrimmage. He made plays when he had to. He was emotional. Brady's a very emotional guy. It's kind of fun to watch.
Did you see the cutaway scene when they showed him on the Jumbotron during the break, and then he sees himself on the Jumbotron and starts cheering on with the fans?
Yeah, I did see that. And what was weird is CBS showed it, the video, but they showed it while there was a live audio of the game. And at that point in the game, nothing was really happening. So it looked like, to me on TV, it looked like Brady was pumping up the crowd and absolutely nobody was paying attention or reacting. I know that could not possibly have been the case. I'm sure in Foxborough it was very loud there. Brady was great, and something he does really well as a player, I mean, the emotional stuff aside, is dictate matchups with his pre-snap adjustments and recognize mismatches. And in other words, he throws the ball to Julian Edelman, because Edelman against linebackers, that was a big theme in the game. The Patriots knew where the Colts cornerbacks were going to line up. And because they knew that, they were able to dictate matchups on the inside. And we saw them do that tremendously, especially with Edelman, who had third down conversions. He had five of those, plus a fourth down conversion. And I can't wait to discuss that one at length about Seattle, because that's a different type of defense, but not completely, because he knows what you're going to get from Seattle's defense against certain formations as well. But anyway, against Indianapolis, they had a great command of what the Colts were doing, and they exploited any soft spot they could locate.
What I love about this Patriots team, too, is the Patriots team we saw week one is completely different than this one. Now it is a running team. It's a power running team, 177 yards on 40 attempts, 148 of those from LeGarrette Blount.
Yeah, but keep in mind, just one game ago, they were a complete non-running team. I mean, they had 14 yards rushing on 13 attempts, I think it was.
Statistically.
And that was, that was it.
No, I mean, but you've taught me, Andy, that, running formations, that doesn't make – it's still a running team if you're not going to the run out of those formations, right?
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah.
That's what I mean.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, in that regard, yeah, I agree with you because they have a very good play-action run game and hard run action. And what hard run action is basically play action, but where the handoffs look really fast, and then the quarterback, as soon as he pulls the ball back and gets ready to throw, he fires immediately. Play action itself is a very slow-developing type of play because you have to go slow to let the fake look like, become believable. But the hard run action, you're trying to get a safety to jump hard and bite, and they were able to do that a few times. They had success with that against Indianapolis and LaRon Landry. And I would think they're going to attempt it against Seattle. Now, I don't know if they'll have the same kind of success, but that's a big part of their offense. You're right. And the other thing they've done a lot more that they didn't do as much, they've done it before, but not as much, is this six-man offensive line. And about half of their running snaps last game against Indianapolis, they had Fleming on the field as a sixth lineman.
I really like LeGarrette Blount. I think he's awesome. You see him break that. I think it was like 12 yards or 14 yards was like his big run of the day there in the first half. And he knows he's not fast enough to beat the whole defense. So he turns into tacklers. He turns back around and goes into a tackler.
Yeah, no, I know the player you're talking about.
I started dying
laughing.
I've never
been a big LeGarrette Blount guy, but I will say this. That AFC Championship, he looked like a totally different runner. I mean, if you take the name off the jersey, I would have said, well, the guy's got LeGarrette Blount's body, but this cannot possibly be LeGarrette Blount.
But he's running like Marshawn Lynch.
Yeah, I mean, with that lateral agility, yeah. And he showed it on several snaps. He played by far the best game I've ever seen him play.
Even the four touchdown game last year?
Oh yeah, because those. So often, running back touchdowns
well,
are just a product of the play. I mean, it's they get the carries that happen to be near the end zone. Yeah, he was much better. This is by far his best game as a pro.
I'm sure he'll be happy to hear that, Andy. He loves praise from this podcast.
I hope he doesn't listen because I've said so many bad things about him over the years, and we know what he does to people from Boise. I hope he's not tuning in.
Hey, what do you think of Gronkowski? Only 3 catches in this one.
Yeah, they did a good job on him. I was glad to see them use some quarters coverage, double teams on him. I went into the game hoping they'd do that because I did a breakdown on it, and they've had success before with that. The main play I'm talking about is the DeQuell Jackson interception. That was out of kind of a Tampa 2 quarters coverage hybrid approach that was played extremely well, and that's the kind of thing you have to do against Gronkowski. You got to throw different guys at him from different angles. You can't throw just one guy at him. And that's something Seattle's going to do very well. They've always done it well, is help coverage concepts, helping each other out on the inside, understanding zones and everyone's responsibilities. And they're going to match up to Gronkowski. That'll be a fascinating matchup. And then the other part is, if New England detaches Gronkowski from the formation, which they did a few times, and the Colts kept Vontae Davis out there on him, how will the Seahawks react to that? My guess is they'll copy what the Colts did because it worked really well, and they'll keep their cornerback outside against Gronkowski.
How does that work? I mean, when you're thinking about it, Gronkowski on a little corner, that doesn't seem like it should work.
No, I agree with you, but the corner has ball skills and an understanding of technique and a refinement there that Gronkowski just cannot match on offense. A cornerback against the tight end in coverage, the cornerback's going to win that more times than not.
But, Andy, it's like a transformer going up against Shia LaBeouf. He's huge.
Yeah, but, John, in this game, it's going to be – I mean, we almost need to save this conversation for next year, week one, because it's irrelevant in this game. Because if he's outside against a corner, it's going to be against either Maxwell or Sherman, and they both have good size.
And that's the reachability there.
And that's why I think if I'm New England, I put Gronkowski on the Sherman side. I'm a huge Maxwell fan, the more I think about it. I think he's an absolutely tremendous player. And
a little more
long
versatile,
arms,
too.
The reach that you speak about, I think that makes him a unique prospect and a guy that you really can't complete passes against. I think Gronkowski would match up better to Sherman than he would against Maxwell. And against the Colts, they kept Gronkowski when they did split him out wide. It was almost always to the left, to Vontae Davis's side, and very rarely to the right. And I'm not sure why that is, unless maybe, you know, when they do their hard run action, I think Tom Brady, and I'd have to ask a PFF guy or something to do this, but my sense is Tom Brady throws to the left more than to the right. So Brady off a play action is more comfortable, I think, throwing to his left. And maybe that's why they put Gronkowski out there.
Let's stick with the Patriots and go into some of these newsy NFL topics and start with the Patriots. Deflategate, deflating footballs below the 14-ounce weight requirement. What do you think about this?
I don't really know what to make of it, but I don't think it's as big a deal. I don't think this is like Spygate. Because if you look at the NFL rule, and it states specifically in the rules what the fine is for this violation, and it's a minimum fine, so they could be more, but they say it's a $25,000 fine. Well, to me, I mean, $25,000, that's the equivalent of five guys wearing the wrong color of socks in a game. I mean, that's not a very big fine. And Spygate, I believe, was a six-figure, I think it's a $100,000 fine. We'll have to double-check that. But it's, you know, if it's only a $25,000, I mean, is it bad to do? Yes, of course. Should you not do it? Yeah, of course. The officials need to monitor it closely? Probably.
But they do. They do monitor that. Don't they inspect the balls right before the game? How intricate
game,
would
should the officials in the, I mean, someone obviously dropped the ball on this at some point, and the Patriots, that's how they got away with it. So
that was a shameless pun.
No, it was not a pun at all. And I tried to think of something else to say, and I were in the moment. I couldn't do it, so I just had dropped the ball, and I hoped that you would have the courtesy to not call it a pun because it's not. I mean, I didn't say drop the inflated ball. So someone dropped the inflated ball, whatever it is. They didn't pay as close enough attention, most likely. I mean, again, I don't know the details of what went on, but obviously it's not what you want if you're the NFL. But based on the way the rule's written, I doubt this is regarded as a very serious thing.
Did you – you don't have time to troll around the internet like I do, but did you see what Brady said on radio right after the game when they were talking about the deflating balls?
Well, I mean, he dismissed it.
Yeah, he just laughed it off.
I forget the quote.
No, all I heard was – I heard a clip of him just laughing and going, I guess I've heard it all now.
No, well, you haven't, because there's going to be more about this deflated ball thing. He's going to be asked about the Super Bowl – with no question, but there's not going to be anything to it. And you do wonder who came up with the idea, who came up with the decision to do it. But I wouldn't read. Fortunately, it was such a one-sided affair that I think we can all agree the deflated balls did not have an impact on the outcome of the game. But it's annoying to really have to even be talking about it.
Yeah, no, it's stupid. And especially that now everyone that hates the Patriots wants to build the narrative that Belichick is this big cheater. Well, it's been a decade since they won a Super Bowl, so they're not cheating well enough then.
Yeah, and the people that argue that, it's been a decade. Belichick hasn't won since Spygate. Keep in mind, the year that Spygate happened, and they got busted for it in week one. So we can be willing to bet that although they were brazen about it, they probably didn't do it in week 2 through 17 that year. They still went undefeated that season, and they stomped a lot of those teams into the ground early in the year. So it's the whole I don't buy into the Patriots, they're cheaters, and they get caught kind of thing. I mean, you know, do they probably skirt the gray areas of the rules? Yeah, most likely, but I would think more than half the league probably does that.
Let's hit on Andrew Luck. Reports are now saying that he could become the highest-paid player in the NFL. But after this loss, Jim Mercer seemed a little bit, a little sluggish on that, tapping the brakes, saying Luck, he's completed 3 years of a five-year deal. He's still got some time left on his current deal.
Yeah, Mercer might have a good point. And they did that with Peyton Manning. You know, they made Peyton Manning complete the entirety of his rookie contract. Andrew Luck's a guy that he comes from a house with money, and he went back to college for an extra year. So I would think if any QB would be, okay with having to wait, it would be Andrew Luck. Not that he's okay with having to wait, but he could tolerate it. If you do that, if you wait a little bit, then you've got a team now that just came a game short of the Super Bowl. And in Luck's first year, they were a wild card team. They lost in the wild card. The next year, they lost in the divisional round. The next year, this year, they lost in the conference championship round. So they're clearly progressing at a very gradual rate, which is the way teams are built to progress. If you wait two more years to pay Andrew Luck, there's reason to believe that you could put the final pieces together for a Super Bowl team. And so they've got the salary cap space to do it now, but they'll have the space to do it next year or the year after that, and they're going to have to, obviously. I would wait one more year if I'm them. I mean, Ursay makes a good point. There's 2 years left on the five-year deal, and you might be able to finagle an extra piece or two and move some money around correctly in the right way. If you wait one more year.
Yeah, he's got a lot of deals he still has to make. I mean, I think we would both agree that no quarterback in the NFL has done more with less than Andrew Luck.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah.
I mean, to the stretch of where they've gone in the playoffs, it's just it's baffling that Luck was even in that situation.
Yeah, and it's commendable to him. And something else that's encouraging is that while they haven't had a lot of guys around him, the guys that they have put around him have gotten better with him each year. I mean, look at T.Y. Hilton, who was a role player early in his career. And he's young, so, you know, he's still early in his career. But he was the number three, essentially, until maybe even this season. Dante Moncrief, in the more immediate present tense here, he got better as the course of his rookie season unfolded. It's impressive the way the Colts have done this. They're absolutely building it the right way and around the right guy.
If Luck stays in Indianapolis for the next 10 or however many years, would that kind of remind you of a little like Brady situation? He can beat up on the AFC South for the stretch of the season and then take a team into the playoffs and win a couple of games when they matter, just like Brady has dominated the AFC East for a decade.
Well, yeah, I mean, if he dominates the South, I guess it'd be similar to Brady in that regard. But we don't know what's going to happen with the AFC South. You know, Jacksonville and Tennessee, they're picking early in the draft each year here, and at some point those draft picks might accumulate to something.
Hey, Andy, since our last show, several coaching positions have been filled, including most recently those two blue and orange teams, Chicago and Denver, got some new head coaches. Let's get the easy one out of the way first. John Fox is in Chicago.
Yeah, it makes sense. You have a defensive guy there, and as I've been saying all year, I think they do need to overhaul the defense, both in terms of scheme and personnel. And Fox gives him a chance to do that, although he's been a zone-based guy himself at times. So, you know, maybe he'll stick with the zone. I would hope not, though. What do you do with Jay Cutler? That's really the decision that they have to make. And it's not just Fox. It's also new GM Ryan Pace.
Young guy. Is he the youngest in the NFL now?
As a general manager, I believe he is.
I think he is 36 or 37, something like that. This seemed like the first hire in this head coaching spree that actually addressed the need of the team. You know what I mean? So we saw a lot of defensive guys go to teams with good defenses. Here's a defensive guy going to Chicago with a terrible defense.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I like that. I see what you're saying there. And the defense was what lost the games for him last year. I know Jay Cutler had an insane number of turnovers, and he led the league in turnovers. It was 24, six lost fumbles and 18 interceptions. But the defense was the problem in Chicago last season, and that's what Fox will have to fix. But I think really it's more on Ryan Pace right now, because he's a guy who inherits a team that's ready to win right now, theoretically, on offense. I mean, they have all the big investments there. They got talent at the right spots. And if Cutler gets going, then that's a very, very good offense. So he inherits the team ready to win right now, but he's tasked with totally rebuilding the defense.
We wonder what Pace and Fox will do with Cutler, but they don't really have that much of a choice with all that guaranteed money.
Yeah, not really, because, I mean, if you cut him now, it's $19 million in dead money. That's
steep.
A dead quarterback on your roster. You can't do that. And then also it gets into the issue of where do you find a better QB. This is why guys like Cutler, the Jeff George types, they call them coach killers, because you always have that argument, where do you find a more talented quarterback to work with? And the answer is you don't find one, usually, unless you're at the very top of this year's draft, which would make, you know, you'd have to cut Cutler and then trade up. So now you're giving yourself $19 million in dead money, plus you're probably spending multiple high draft choices just to get rid of them. You're not going to do that. And so your next best option is, well, hey, I can be the guy that tames this wild horse. I can be the one that gets the most out of him, when in fact the guy with all the talent doesn't ever learn how to corral it, and now you're, you know, Cutler's on, what is this, his fourth different head coach now, yeah. I believe.
Yeah, and with Jay Cutler, there's got to be a point where you stop playing talent and have to go with production, right? He's been in the league a long time.
Yeah, there is, but we're not at that point now because of what we just talked about. They can't afford the dead money or find a guy better. So they're going to have to live or die with Cutler for at least one more season here.
Andy, we predicted Gary Kubiak to Denver.
You did. I'm impressed. You called that. I hadn't even thought of it at the time.
Yeah, well, see, I got my fingertips all over this league.
Okay. I don't quite understand the hire because, and I'm not criticizing the hire. I'm saying I don't understand it from the standpoint of what does this mean for Peyton Manning?
Yeah, that's so weird because Kubiak's known for, I mean, he doesn't really change his offense at these last two stops he's been at, but you're not rolling out Peyton Manning at age 38.
No, he's not going to go outside the pocket. And you weren't going to do that at age 28 or
even
age 18. No. Peyton Manning's not that kind of a QB. Now, what I also find interesting is Manning, as I've heard it, he wanted to go to Houston when he was a free agent a few years ago.
Oh.
And the Texans, who were coached by Gary Kubiak at that time, were the only team that was not interested in Manning, who was on that was on Manning's list. Manning wanted them. They didn't want him. So Kubiak has clearly felt that way, that he'd rather play with a certain type of QB. Now, my sense is, my guess would be Kubiak sat down with John Elway and Elway said, this is my team, and you know, we're hiring you to be the coach, and we're going to have Peyton Manning on the team. And as a coach, as a good coach, what a good coach would do there is amend his offense to fit his personnel, especially if his personnel is a first-ballot Hall of Fame quarterback.
Now, what do you think of Adam Gase, previous top offensive play caller there in Denver?
He hasn't gotten a job yet. Now, he's interviewing in Baltimore at the time that we're recording this, and that interview came up very quickly because, at least it seemed to. I mean, I guess because Kubiak left just a few days ago, so they've probably known Kubiak's gone for the last 4 or 5 days. I'm surprised he hasn't found a job yet. I understand why he's not being hired as a head coach because he is still very young, and I think there are aspects to his approach to the profession that show that he's young. He's just inexperienced at this point. I think he will be a head coach one day, and he'll probably be a very good one. He's been around some great people in his career, and he's a smart, affable guy. But the sense around the league is he's not ready yet. And so that's not surprising, but I am a little surprised that someone hasn't rolled out the red carpet for him as an offensive coordinator at this point. And I know he interviewed in Jacksonville, for example. Could you imagine going from Denver to Jacksonville and someone telling you that was a lateral move?
Well, yeah, but depending on how Jacksonville does over the next 2 years, that could lead to a head gig. So maybe he's just sitting and waiting in the bullpen to try to take over for when Gus Bradley gets shoved out.
Yeah, good point, because he would have a lot of autonomy as the offensive coordinator in Jacksonville. I've heard that he likes Blake Bortles as a QB, so he's got a guy he wants to work with. And he'd have a young passing game that he could mold. And so if he does, you're right, if he does do that successfully, then he'll be considered for a head coaching job because he'll be viewed as the guy that turned around Jacksonville.
How about the 49ers staying in-house, going with Jim Tomsula, defensive line coach? Kind of a surprise to everyone on the outside, but from what I'm hearing, it seems like the good football move.
Yep, that's what I'm hearing as well. And I don't know about Jim Tomsula's philosophy. I mean, none of us know his football philosophy, that is. None of us know because, for one, he's not saying. I don't know if you've seen any interviews that he's done, but they're hilarious, and he won't give anything away at all. He'll politely just, you know, he'll grunt and make noises instead of say anything, which is fine by me. But for two, he's never had to show his philosophy because he's never been a head coach or even a coordinator in the NFL. So we don't know where he'll go in that regard, but he's going to let he said he will let his coordinators be the guys in charge, and he'll be a head coach who manages games. And from that standpoint, I think they've got a good guy here. And I know players like Jim Tomsula. I had a chance to meet him at the Combine last year. And he just oozes old-school football guy. Very, very friendly. A nice guy. But he told me, and I wrote this summer, I think maybe, for MMQB the other day. But, you know, he said that he backed up or screwed up the servers at San Francisco because he doesn't check his email, but you know he returns every phone call that he gets. He's and I know that's not important, it has nothing to do with what kind of a coach he is, but I think that paints a picture of what kind of a guy he is.
Yeah, I've gotten the impression from everything I'm reading that, like you said, a good players coach guy. Not a big name, though. Not a big name hire there in San Francisco. Does this feel at all like the Yorks want to have more control and that Jim Harbaugh wanted to control too much of this football team?
Yeah, it could feel that way, yes. And I think we all thought that it was Harbaugh and Balky not getting along, but it sounds like it was more Harbaugh and the Yorks not getting along, and then Balky was just happened to be on the side of the Yorks. But Harbaugh ran into – there are whispers around the league that Harbaugh had similar issues at Stanford with the powers that be there. And so now everybody gets what they want. The Yorks have a head coach that isn't a headline grabber or whatever the problem was with Harbaugh. And Jim Harbaugh probably gets to do what he wants at Michigan.
Oh, yeah, they gave him the keys to the castle in Michigan.
Yeah. So it works out for everybody. Now, it won't be viewed that way as a win-win unless the Niners continue to win. And it's interesting. I don't know if we've ever seen – oh, boy, I wish we thought of this before the show because we could have researched it. I wonder if we've ever seen a head coach – kind of a, not to be disrespectful, but a no-name head coach take over a team that had been so successful in recent years and is so ready to continue to be successful.
I don't know. That's a good question. Maybe we'll look that up for the next one.
The one guy I could think is like Barry Switzer with the Cowboys after Jimmy Johnson, but Barry Switzer was not a no-name. He came from the college ranks, though.
Yeah, exactly. Last but not least, Todd Bowles going to the Jets.
He's going to have some trouble there, I think, initially.
Ooh,
because
you like Todd Bowles.
I know. I love Todd Bowles, and that's why I say initially. I hope he sticks around there. But that the Jets have nothing to work with personnel-wise, and especially nothing by the standards of Todd Bowles' scheme and what he needs from his players. Todd Bowles manufactures pressure with an unbelievable volume of aggressive blitzes. And the only way you can play that way, the only way you can be willing to go cover zero blitz as often as he does, or triple A gap blitz as often as he does, is if you have good man-to-man corners on the outside. And the Jets have zero. In fact, the Jets need their 1, 2, and 3 cornerback positions are all vacant right now.
Yeah, the secondary is a mess. But, Andy, this is the less is more coordinator of the league. Like, Todd Bowles has been able to get so much out of that Arizona defense.
Oh, you mean because despite all the
injuries, suspensions, you know, whatever.
Well, there was one guy, and this year two guys that did not get hurt and were not suspended and did not leave the team, and that's cornerback Patrick Peterson and the other cornerback who joined the team, Antonio Cromartie.
They're pretty good at football, yep.
Yeah, and it's not just – John, those guys aren't – I mean, I think Peterson's a star, and I think at times he looks like the, you know, a top 3 or 4 cornerback. I don't think he is that, though, because he's far too inconsistent. But he's able to play in man coverage, and he's able to play cover zero man, and they're willing to risk that with him. They were. Todd Bowles was. And when you have a cornerback, never mind if they can, you know, thrive in it, just the ability to do it comfortably and at least attempt it. Often that's all you need, and the scheme takes care of the rest because the blitz pressure gets there. But you have to have a guy who you're at least willing to ask to play in man-to-man on an island, and the Jets they don't begin to have that, and they don't have linebackers right now. David Harris will be a free agent. I don't think he comes back. I'd be surprised. They don't have any safeties. You don't know what you're getting in Calvin Pryor, their rookie first-round pick from last year, and they have a bunch of free agents at that position as well. And that's just the defense with Todd Bowles. I mean, by the way, on offense, they have no quarterback.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe it was wrong for me to compare the Cardinals, who have like 5 potential all-pros in their secondary, to the Jets.
Yeah, it probably was. You'll learn.
Gee, thanks. I really appreciate that. Kyle Shanahan, Falcons, offensive coordinator. Did this surprise you at all?
Yeah, because they don't have a head coach yet.
Yeah, that's a weird deal because now the coach comes in knowing that the offense is accounted for. Keep your hands where they belong. You know what I mean?
Well, I think the coach comes in saying, boy, I'm sure glad we didn't get caught doing all those under-the-table communications when I was still coaching the Seahawks defense because – you know, I understand it. We need to get the staff set, and you need to get moving forward. And the Seahawks, by winning, you know, by making the Super Bowl now,
they're ruining Dan Quinn's future
and his process with the Falcons. So, I understand what they do, and I understand why they hired it. And obviously, Atlanta is very comfortable. They're getting Dan Quinn, and that's a good hire for them.
We're going to try to do another one of these before the Super Bowl.
Oh, another podcast?
Yeah.
Of course, man.
Okay.
If it's Super Bowl week, we'll talk real football. I mean, not that we didn't today, but we'll talk everything there is about the matchup. And you know, by that point, everyone will be all tired of the Super Bowl anyway, so we'll just get to go on and cruise on that one. It'll be like a substitute teacher talking to a class in seventh
grade. Yeah, we'll be putting on a movie and just letting them coast out for 45 minutes.
Yeah, but there's, you know, I spent all day. I know I'm in Mobile here, but the coaches weren't here yet. And so I got to spend all day today thinking about this matchup and writing about it and breaking down aspects of it. And it's a very fascinating one, especially with New England's offense against Seattle's defense.
Yeah, definitely. Bring us some stories back from Mobile.
All right, I'll do my best.
All right, that's all we have for you this week. Remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Just search MMQB. You can follow Andy at Andy_Benoit on Twitter and myself at Ingles Angle. We'll see you next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.